It's time for hour number two of the Bible study, the Ask the Pastor Hour. Or in this case, Ask the Executive Director. My guest is Pastor Dave Andrus. He is pastor, well, I guess executive director and pastor of Lutheran Blind Mission. Good morning, Pastor.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us here today on this lovely autumn day.
Yeah.
Any projects underway with Lutheran Blind Mission that you can bring us up to speed on?
We're in the process of redesigning the large Prince Lutheran service book. It won't be ready to come out until January. We've heard from a lot of people that the large print really wasn't needed that large by most people, so we're downsizing it, which will make us be able to put it into two volumes instead of the seven volume set. So we're kind of excited about that.
Seven volumes?
Yeah.
That's pretty big.
It is, although each volume is like a magazine. So it's not heavy.
Oh, I see.
And we thought from our field testing that this would be a good approach, and for some it was, but for most people who are using the large print hymnal, their eyesight is not quite as severely lost as we thought it would be, and so the large print wasn't quite as necessary. It'll still be very large. It's, I think, 18-point instead of 21-point.
So review for us what is the your primary work at Lutheran Blind Mission.
We actually, it's interesting you say that, because I was just looking at our purpose statement, and we have two verbs in the purpose statement. Provide material, actually I guess it's one verb, provide, but it's two things, materials and leadership. And under the materials, we provide resources from magazines, devotionals, the Lenny Library, the hymnal, which I just spoke about, catechisms. And then the leadership, we provide leaderships to help congregations form outreach centers that can reach out to blind and visually impaired people, or leadership in helping congregations find new and innovative ways to help their members be more part of the congregation. And then directly, we help blind people be better leaders, reaching out, especially to share the news of Jesus with others, because they're so much in contact with blind and vision impaired people, and they're by and large to rest of society rather hidden, but not to other blind and vision impaired. So if we can help them reach out, we'll be effectively reaching a whole segment of society, 4%, 12 million, that are untapped and connected to right now.
Well, I want to ask you a question here about a story that I found on the Associated Press radio wire from Terre Haute, Indiana. And I thought, I don't know, just toss this out. It occurred to me that you might have an interesting perspective on this.
Okay.
But the story says Terre Haute, Indiana's newest church does not have walls or a roof. But that hasn't stopped it from delivering its message. The New Birth Community Church holds choir practice and Bible studies in vacant lots in Gilbert Park, near neighborhoods plagued by drugs, prostitution, and poverty. Bishop Christopher Graham says many of those attending services are intimidated by a church building. The 23-year-old pastor says that makes the outdoor setting ideal. Worship services are held Sunday afternoons at 2 p.m. Graham says he is looking for a building for the future, but is not in a rush. He might add a bonfire to the services when the weather turns colder, which it will eventually in Terre Haute, Indiana.
Yeah.
So, a couple of questions here, and the first one is, I remember you telling me a story one time. Maybe it was here at the chapel at Concordia Seminary, but how for a person who is not sighted, how intimidating it can be to go into a church building, just because unless you've got help, it's not very easy.
That is correct.
So how do you feel about this statement here? Many of those attending services are intimidated by a church building. Now, I realize he's talking about a completely different dynamic. But from your perspective, what's your reaction to that statement?
I'm intrigued by this, because it is very much the case. It's not just the building, but all that the building represents. And that usually means the institutional church, the way God has been formed and delivered two people and it, how that is connected to the institutional church with its expectations, its values that not always are true, but certainly are an underlying message along with the message of Christianity. And that really is, it's not so much the building, even for people who are blind and visually impaired, that are, well, no, that's not true. Actually, the buildings can be a difficulty for those who are blind and visually impaired getting through, but with a few people's help, they can get in. But what happens inside, what's expected inside, and the message inside, that is equally intimidating to blind and visually impaired people as it is for many other groups in society, such as the poor, the destitute, and the homeless.
Well, now there are probably a few people, maybe including myself, who are just not following that. I had a feeling that this story might touch a Dave Andrus nerve.
Yes.
But you're talking about something that I guess is just completely outside my experience.
Mm-hmm.
Can you bring me into that world?
Yeah, I'll try. One story, this... Well, I'll give you a couple examples, and hopefully a couple of these will ring true. I was speaking with one of our Outreach Center directors just a week ago, and she mentioned, and I'll name the gal Sue. Sue had just lost her sight and started coming 2 years ago to the Outreach Center. And after coming three times, the director leaned over and said, "So what do you think about our Outreach Center, and what do you think about the pastor?" And by the way, our Outreach Centers are... on non-church times. I think this one was on a Saturday lunch time. And Sue said, "Quite frankly, I don't like your pastor, and even more so, I don't like God." And our director...
Whoa.
Yeah. And the director went, okay, mental note. And so she started contacting Sue even more than she had. And in the next ensuing months, she learned Sue was angry at God because... when Sue was a child, her mom died, and Sue blamed God for taking her mom from her at such an early age. And throughout her life, she had anger at God and everything God stood for. And the only reason she was coming to the Outreach Center is there was a lot of blind people coming, and she needed some help dealing with her blindness. Now, the director said when she understood that, they even went more out of their way to help Sue experience care, kindness, and compassion. And as the director told me this just a week ago, she said last week, for the first time, Sue called her up and said, "I need prayers. Would you and the Outreach Center pray for me and my family?" It took a year and a half of work to start melting away the bitterness and the anger she had at God. And it took the loss of her sight to get that to happen. Another story. This one happened in Philadelphia. A gentleman who was blind and his sighted wife heard about our outreach center, so they went to the address, and when they stopped at the address, they looked again. The wife looked again at the paper, looked up, and said, "It's a church." And he said, "Let's get out of here." And Martha, the director, was on a railroad car traveling to a... well, it doesn't matter. She was on vacation traveling, and she heard this cane tapping and said, "Hi, I'm Martha. I'm blind, too. I have a seat." And that's how she learned this story, because Martha just started engaging the conversation, and Martha said, "Well, I'm at an outreach center in Philadelphia. Whoa, I had this weird happening. I went to this, and it was a church, and churches don't do that. They don't do nice things like that." And Martha said, "Oh, well, that's our outreach center, and yes, we do." And this man's impression was churches only demand of their people rules and regulations and compliance to their code of ethics. And there was no thought or concept of kindness, compassion, human relationships, let alone the love of God. And I think a lot of people in poverty feel the same way, that God has passed them by. The story yesterday in the gospel, which was read in many of our churches, was this rich young ruler who knelt down and said, "What must I do to inherit heaven?" He wanted God's favor. And Jesus said, well, keep the commandments. And the man said, well, I've done that. And, well, Jesus knew his heart, but he also loved the man. He said, so go sell everything. Because he knew this man not only was rich, might have been his clothes or his reputation, but he also knew the man had difficulty with his possessions. He said, go sell it all, give it to the poor, then you'll have treasure in heaven. Then you'll have favor with God. Then follow me. And he went away very sad. It was a shock to the disciples because they believed riches equated with God's favor. You wouldn't have riches, you wouldn't have a good life if God wasn't pleased with you. Well, this man had lots of riches, so God must be pleased with him. The disciples will hear in next Sunday's readings, who then can be saved if this rich man can't? And Jesus' comment was, well, I'll hold off on that. But the point I want to make with this is our world still thinks that way, that if everything's going good and great, God's pleased with you. But when things aren't going great, when you lost your house, when your spouse dies, when you fill in the blank, God's angry at you. And I think that's what keeps a lot of people away from churches, especially those who are poor and destitute. They don't think God's on their side.
Is it unfair for the rest of us, those who are sighted, those who are not necessarily struggling with some very difficult issue, to look at the folks who are and say, well, you know, they just have a chip on their shoulder. You know, we're open to all people, and we love all people. But so-and-so over there, he has a chip on his, Sue has a chip on her shoulder. And she needs to get over that, and then maybe we can get somewhere. What do you think of that attitude?
That's what's keeping them, that's what's the final lock on the door keeping them away. When Christians have that attitude, you need to change and have a better attitude. Those who are struggling, they conclude, see, I knew it. You don't have a clue. You don't understand what I'm going through. So why should I even come and step into your church or worship your God? Because you don't understand, and obviously, therefore, he doesn't understand either. Quite the opposite, I think, as a pastor needs to be done, is we need to reverse it and say, we have the chip on our shoulders and we need to change, and say, you're right, we don't understand, but what can we do to help you? How can we better understand?
Well, usually I think of a person who has the cliched chip on his shoulder as having a kind of a negative attitude or a dour outlook on life because of some low card he or she has been dealt.
Mm-hmm.
I don't usually think of the person who is regular in worship, comfortable in worship, comes in a nice car, goes home to a fairly nice house,
mm-hmm.
kids are pretty well dressed, as having a chip on his or her shoulder.
Well, they do when they look at the poor and the destitute and think, you've got to change your attitude. That's the chip I'm referring to. Because it's that smug attitude that I'm okay, life's good for me, why don't you come and find God and he'll help you. It's that attitude that keeps people away.
All right, so that would be, I think we could probably put that under the heading of bad attitude, but let's explore it from another perspective.
Okay.
If I'm a person who is, and I guess I am actually now that I think about it, and not wrestling with some of the issues that we've described here,
mm-hmm.
and I perceive, maybe rightly so, like Sue,
mm-hmm.
the person that you described, Sue didn't like God and didn't like church very much.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible for me to have a genuine fear that, gee, I'd like to say something, I'd like to do something, but because there seems to be a predisposition there on the negative, I don't want to make it worse. I don't want to say something or do something that might inadvertently confirm their suspicions. And so, you know, better off to bite my tongue and not make that mistake. What would you say?
That's the next thing that closes the shutters on the windows for those people. First was the attitude that locked the door, and now it's even shutting out the light that's shining inside. That fear does stop people, and I know that. But when people don't speak, that's a loud voice already fulfills, and probably falsely so, for Sue or others who are struggling that way. It's a quiet but strong voice. I'm right, you're wrong. By saying nothing, because then it's fulfilling their thoughts. A different story. Cheryl, who lives up in Michigan, related to me how she was raised not as a Christian, but her teenage friends said, "Why don't you come to church with me?" And so Cheryl started coming to church. She liked it. It was neat. And so she went to the pastor and said, "I'd like to join." And so she took classes, confirmation classes, and was confirmed with all the other kids. 2 months after she was confirmed, she went blind. And she concluded, I wasn't in church. I come to church. I join church. I'm blind. That must be God saying he doesn't want me there. So she stopped coming. And no one came after her. No one spoke to her. No one did anything. And so she lived for 20 or more years with that thought confirmed because no one said otherwise.
I wasn't involved, and I still feel the shame of it.
It's what gets me out of my comfort zone to say something when I'm on the train, as I was last night, or on a bus, or on an airplane, or anywhere I am, to try to say something that can move the conversation to Jesus. Worst person can be is, get out of my face. Well, okay, I'll get out of their face. It might be that they'll go, tell me more.
Have you had it happen, I bet you have, where somebody who, just like you described Cheryl there, 20 years of what really is a wrong conclusion, and you're the one who breaks through to that person and gives them the truth that has been denied them or has not been given to them in 20 years, and you're the one who breaks. Have you had that experience?
Yes, I have.
What is that like?
It sends tingles all the way up and down your fingers and toes and arms and legs, and you're just so excited because you realize that they're seeing the light, that they're catching on, that all of a sudden their doom and gloom and their anger melts away, and they get excited, and they for the first time are thinking, God loves me? He cares about me? When you have that experience, it'll keep you going for a year.
When a person is not in church, does not have a church-going rearing, finds her way to church, becomes confirmed, and 2 months later loses her sight, what other possible conclusion can you draw? Other than, obviously, God is not pleased with me.
When I have situations like that, I first go and sit with them. I try to go out of my way to find them and talk with them and listen. And I don't even try to give answers. Because at that point when they say, why did this happen? They're not looking for information. They're looking for, what now? Where is God? And one thing that I will say to a person like that is, it's a good thing you do know God, because, boy, if you didn't know God and this happened, boy, where would you be then?
And
that makes them stop and think, if I were blind and I didn't know God, life would be worse. But I know God, and I'm blind, and he's there to help me. And that's then where, again, Christians need to be supportive in showing kindness and compassion. And as they do in the midst of these struggles and difficulties, it will reinforce before them the reality that God is real, He is present, and He does love them.
Pastor Andrus, when you're dealing with somebody who is blind or somebody who has some significant issue, mm-hmm. whatever that might be,
mm-hmm.
that tends to cause them to maybe be regarded by the rest of us as having somehow come up short.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever talk to them about the next life? Do you ever say to a blind person, well, you know, what we got to do here is we got to get you saved so that you can enjoy eternal life? You know, in eternal life, you will not have these infirmities. You will not have these weaknesses. But you will be perfect. Do you ever talk in those terms?
It's interesting that you asked the question. I never gave it a thought pointedly to that. No, I don't. No, I don't. And there's probably two reasons, maybe three. We in America especially are a more immediate gratification type of people. And to speak about down the road is extremely hard. Extremely hard. And that's one reason why people don't get off of drugs and alcohol. They live for the moment, not the future. Secondly, though, I believe that if people are to be saved, they need to know God is real and present for them right now, not something waiting at the end of this life, because then this life is miserable. And it doesn't have to be miserable. It can be good. It can be wonderful when they know that God is with them. And so I speak more to the point of that God is with them and help them to understand how even our Jesus, our Savior, He was beaten, battered, and thrown aside by society as well. His body was broken. By His brokenness, we're forgiven. But not only that, He understands what it means to hurt and have loss and be broken. And He didn't get rid of that. He showed His hands inside. He is our Savior now.
Well, that is an interesting perspective, because I've often wondered if it were not true that when Jesus was making His way around Palestine in the 3 years or so of His public ministry,
mm-hmm.
talking about the kingdom of God and the coming kingdom of God, and perhaps talking about that time when every tear will be wiped away. You know, the people in the first century there in Palestine, the underprivileged, the oppressed, were more numerous than those who had it good.
Mm-hmm.
The ones who had it good were probably rare, were few. So that talking about a kingdom where there would be no slavery, where there would be no leprosy, where there would be no pain, no anguish, might have had considerably more appeal in the first century. Thus, generating thousands of converts early on,
mm-hmm.
than it would in, say, 21st century America. Let's explore that on the other side of the break here. Pastor Dave Andrus is with us. He is the executive director of Lutheran Blind Mission. I'm interested in your take, dear listener, on what you are hearing in this conversation. Because the one thing that I think we can say for sure is that those folks in America who are otherwise middle class and well off, we're not doing a very good job with those who sometimes need us. We ignore them, and we should be ashamed. We'll be right back.
Want to nail down your own free copy of the new Lutheran Study Bible? Well, listen for Luther hammering the 95 Theses to the church door at Wittenberg. That'll be your cue to call 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727 and register for one of several new Lutheran Study Bibles from Concordia Publishing House to be given away on KFUO Radio Friday, October 30th, just in time for Reformation Day weekend. In fact, three of our grand prize drawings will include the Treasury of Daily Prayer along with the new Lutheran Study Bible from CPH. So visit the KFUO.org homepage and register via email. Or listen for Luther's Hammer and call us with your name and number. One registration per household, please. Listen for Luther and nail down your free copy of the new Lutheran Study Bible on KFUO Radio.
How smart were our ancestors? Get a clue next on today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moments host, Ian Taylor.
It would not be unusual to find a stone with an engraving on it in South America. But this stone was found in Brazil, where the Aztec, the Mayan, and the Incan civilizations never lived. Besides, the engraving on the stone that was found in 1872 was in Phoenician. Its discoverers, who did not know Phoenician, sent it to the head of a national museum. It reads, "We are the sons of Canaan from Sidon, the city of the king. Commerce has cast us on this distant shore, a land of mountains." Could 7th century BC Phoenicians have sailed as far as South America in search of commerce? In the ancient world, they were known as the greatest commercial sailors of their day. But there is a modern bias against seeing ancient peoples as being as smart and as resourceful as we are today, so the inscription has generally been considered a hoax. Then in the 1960s, the original rubbing made of the inscription turned up at a scholarly auction in the United States. A modern expert on ancient languages has studied the rubbing. He concluded that the inscription must be authentic. It contains quirks of the Phoenician language that were unknown even to scholars in the 19th century. While we today may know more facts, the ancients were no less intelligent and resourceful than we are today. That's consistent with the Bible's picture of man as God's highest visible creation, rather than evolution's gradually improving creature.
For a free copy of our Creation Resource Catalog, visit our website at creationmoments.com or call us toll-free at 1-800-42-BIBLE. And be sure to join us next time for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
The Lutheran Study Bible is the first and only study Bible in English prepared entirely from the ground up by Lutherans, offering a uniquely keen focus on the proper distinction between law and gospel, shining a brilliant light on the heart and center of the Scriptures, Christ and Him crucified, risen, and ascended for your salvation. The Lutheran Study Bible from Concordia Publishing House is all about Jesus in every way for you. With over 26,500 notes, the Lutheran Study Bible has more than any other study Bible available today. These include historic Lutheran cross-references and notes dating back to the Luther Bible of 1534. It has over 31,000 concordance entries, over 880 references linked to the 36 custom-designed maps, 220 thematic articles, and 120 diagrams and charts prepared exclusively for this Bible. The Lutheran Study Bible, the English Standard Version, with study material built entirely by Lutherans to help you correctly handle the Word of God. Visit cph.org.
Well, it seemed appropriate to listen to Luther pounding the nail into the church door in Wittenberg. After listening to Diane extol the virtues of the New Lutheran Study Bible, we'll be giving away Bibles on Friday, October 30th, the day before Reformation Day. And if you would like to be in the drawing for that, you need to call us now at 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. Anytime you hear the hammering of the nails, that is your cue to call. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727 if you would like to get your name in for the big drawing on Friday, October 30th. Sally will take your name and get you in the hopper. Pastor Andrus, we were talking before we got to the bottom of the hour here about some of the things, those things that impede the path of people into the church, people's who paths have already been made crooked by life. Mm-hmm. And I made a comment that some of us who do not have those obstructions should be ashamed of ourselves. Do you agree with that? As soon as I said it, I thought, I wonder what Dave Andrus thinks about that.
Yes and no. And I am also ashamed of myself at times. That's why the no quickly comes in. No, we don't need to be ashamed, but forgiven, and then use that as a motivator, the forgiveness that we have to speak more and to show and to demonstrate to others of God's love. So, yeah, I think if you don't feel shame, you're missing the point of the law. But we need to hear the gospel, which says, I can forgive you even that sin. Now go sin no more.
Well, I'm anxious to hear your take on the issue that I raised before we got to the bottom of the hour, because I'm not a historian, so I could be off on this, but I am under the impression that without modern medicine, without modern sewage facilities, and without modern conveniences, life in the first century was very, very hard, and most of the people who lived it lived that very hard life. Very few people lived in the lap of luxury or comfort. And certainly 21st century Americans, not all of them live in the lap of luxury, but many, many people are comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So that the message of a coming kingdom back in the first century, as preached by Jesus and his followers, would have, it seems to me, had so much more appeal. Because the stuff of life for the average person in first century Palestine was probably drudgery and just not very much happiness. But that's not the case now. If you're a middle class American or above, your lot in life you probably think could always be improved, but it's not bad.
Mm-hmm.
So that I wonder if the appeal of the gospel message isn't as powerful for our culture. Because we're pretty content.
You have hit on two interesting topics, and let's take that second one first, that we're so content with where we are that maybe we aren't so quick to speak of the gospel to others. And I think that is very true. The devil can use all sorts of tools in his toolbox, and one of them is, okay, if I can't win them over by hookery or trickery or witchcraft, well, let's just make their life good. And often people slip away with the wealth of the world and then the worries that come with trying to keep and maintain the wealth of the world, even as Jesus spoke of. As far as the first item, the first century church did live with a lot of heart. Not only the first century church, but just people of the first century, the majority of them, actually, really, all the way up through the 18th century, lived hard, difficult lives, and not one with pleasures and luxuries as we know them today. I think the gospel was easier to speak then, of a gracious God. There was more of a reality of death around the corner. And so when somebody knew that the next day they could catch pneumonia and die because their uncle did just a week ago, they think more about death. They think more about the hereafter. And so as that first century church did speak of the hereafter, it was with the keen sense and reality that death is just one step away. And so it meant more to them. For us, death, step away. No, got the swine flu? We'll just go to the doctor. He can take care of you. How most people think. So death is precluded from our thinking so often. And that's why when death does come, it's such a shock and horror. We don't know what to do about it.
All right, sir, I'm going to change the subject here and move in a different direction, appealing more to your sensibilities as a pastor maybe than the executive director of Lutheran Blind Mission.
Okay.
I have a story here from ChristianPost.com. The headline is Common Word Muslims, Christians Press for Common Deeds. The phrase common word and the phrase common deeds are in quotes.
Okay.
And the story is written by Joshua Goldberg. He says, relevance, aggressive secular attacks, and the threat of extremism are challenges for all people of faith, said former British Prime Minister Tony Blair at a major Muslim-Christian dialogue conference this past week. Quote, these challenges are not for Muslims alone, or Christians, or Jews, Hindus, or Buddhists for that matter. They are challenges for all people of faith. That was a Tony Blair quote from the 2009 Common Word Conference at Georgetown University. And the best hope for faith in the 21st century, the former UK leader added, is that people of faith confront all of this together. He adds, "This is not because we intend to have the same faith. We don't. Our separate beliefs will remain. But our coming together will allow us to speak in friendship to one another about our own faiths, and also speak to the world about faith." Unquote. For 2 days last week, around 1,000 people attended the 2009 Common Word Conference, the fourth such conference held since a 2007 document from 138 Muslim scholars to Christian leaders titled "A Common Word Between Us and You." It called for Christians and Muslims to work together for peace. Like the conferences before it, the gathering on October 7th and 8th focused on the message of the Common Word Initiative, which supporters hope will give Muslims and Christians starting point for cooperation and worldwide coordination while doing so on the most solid theological ground possible. What are your thoughts?
Wow, interesting. I have a couple thoughts. I'm wondering if I should go with my second one first or my first one.
Well, if you follow Bible study tradition, you will go with the second one first.
Is that right?
Yeah.
My second thought was that we here in especially Midwestern America of the United States probably bristle at that, and I bet there's even some listeners who will say, Christians shouldn't be talking with Muslims. We have to speak up for our faith of our Lutheran heritage. And they are right. There is a point where that is true. But then I move to my first thought, is where they are wrong in that there is a place, especially in the left-hand kingdom, that we can speak with other faiths in relationship to our world in taking care of it. And the point of that left-handed kingdom in speaking with other faiths is if we don't learn to get along with other people, pretty quick we're going to lose the prosperity and peace that we have in this country. And when you lose the peace and prosperity that you have as a nation, then we go under extreme persecution, as when in the first two centuries Christianity was against the law. And I would like to say that this is an intriguing thing, that we work with other people in order to maintain a sense of peace so that we can be about the greater work of doing what the second thought was, is then proclaiming our faith, especially of our Lutheran heritage, so that people might know Jesus. When I was over in Europe 2 years ago, England, Norway, Sweden, I was shocked and amazed. I'd heard these stories where you go into a church on Sunday and there's only a couple dozen people. It happened. There were 23 of us in this huge church that could sit probably 400. And in talking with the pastor afterwards, they used to have on roster, but this was the state church of Sweden, 30,000 people. And now they had only 23 show up on Sunday. And then going to England, I was talking with somebody who said that the Muslims outnumber Christians 3-1. 3-1. And he said it's a little nerve-wracking as a Christian to see how much control Muslims are having. And so my point, coming back to this article, is if we can't learn to get along with people on an earthly level in the left-hand kingdom, we're going to find ourselves so marginalized as Christians in the decades, and I pray it's centuries to come, that we won't be able to do a thing but under persecution and threat of death.
Wow.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And that's what the devil wants. He doesn't want the world to be in the control of in the hands of Christians and have peace and prosperity like we have, because we can do missionary work, we can evangelize, we can set a bonfire in a parking lot and call the poor and speak to them of Jesus in a church without walls. But pretty soon, if we're not careful, we won't be able to do any of that.
Hmm. Well, that's kind of a dire prediction.
You can find it laced all over the Bible. I'm not really speaking out of turn from what the prophet spoke. I think we just like to close our eyes to those words, that if we ignore the time and the opportunities, God will move on.
So, how do we... I can see where a guy like yourself, a skillful guy like yourself, could make a so-called left-hand kingdom application to an approach like this and avoid a confusion with a right-hand kingdom approach. But most of the rest of us probably are not qualified to do that. But I think most of the rest of us would say, yippee, yay, let's get those, you know, everything I hear about those Muslims and suicide bombers and beating women and caning people for having a beer and everything. This is great news. They have reached out to Christians. They have said, there is some commonality in your word, what you call your word, the Bible, I guess, in our case, and the Quran, their word. Can we find common ground between those two words, Pastor?
Can I answer it in a slightly different way? What I encourage people is, look at the Apostles' Creed. What is the first article? I believe in God the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. That's our common ground. That we live here on this earth. The earth was created by God, and therefore, let's see what we can do to live together on this earth without fighting each other. Be very open at that point, though, to say, hey, if it comes to worship and prayer, we have to go our separate ways. But there are a few strains here where I think we can talk and be on common ground. It is a difficult thing. You are right, Chuck. And I'm not sure I even have the sophistication and smoothness to handle the left hand and the right hand. I'll be real honest. It's easy here as we're talking on the radio, but put in that situation, it becomes much tougher, much tougher.
Well, for some of us, all we know about Islam is we remember the Crusades, and, you know, those were wars. And now we have what we read about in the media, radical Islam, and that makes us nervous. Is there a peaceful Islam that you're aware of, Pastor, that if you used your skill, one could perhaps embrace in a civil way, a left-hand kingdom way?
Yes, there is. There is. We need, as Christians, to be keenly aware there is a radical right of those out there who hold to the Muslim faith. But there is also a moderate, peaceful group. And that's the ones we can kind of work with to a degree. And I think step number one is you need to, one needs to rub shoulders with them, which means maybe go out of your way to find some people who believe and hold to the Muslim faith. Sit and talk with them. And then you'll realize they're people who go home and eat supper too. And this is the problem with the media. The media, it too often goes to the extremes to make their story, and then we get paranoid that the whole world is like that. And it is not. It is not. So the first thing is to be comfortable and realize there are a lot of people. I was on an airplane two months ago, and I could obviously tell that he was a foreigner. He spoke with a very heavy accent, and as I got talking, I learned, I just came out and asked him, so I can tell you're not originally from America, where are you from? And he said, India, and we got talking, and he said he was a Muslim, and he spoke on, and I realized, this is just a common guy who came here, and he holds dearly to his Muslim faith, and I did express equally, I hold dear to my Jesus and my faith. But I realized I wasn't going to convince him, just as he realized he wasn't going to convince me. But we got off the plane smiling at each other. And I think that's the point we as Christians need to be, that we find that ground where we realize they're just people, and we can be friends and acquaintances as your neighbors or whatever, not in worship, not in prayer, no, but in other aspects, yes.
All right, in the minutes that remain here, one more topic that I'd like to take up with you.
Mm-hmm.
It is a story that has a headline on it that says, this is from Politico.com, Politico.com.
Okay.
The headline is, what's with all the blankety-blank language? You know, they use the ampersand and the percent sign, you know, that kind
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah.
And then it points to Barack Obama, Richard Nixon, Rahm Emanuel, Lyndon Johnson, Kanye West, Abe Rosenthal. There's a whole list of people here mm-hmm. in order to communicate that this is not a partisan observation. The story is by Kenneth Vogel, and he writes, President Barack Obama called rap star Kanye West a jackass. Vice President Joe Biden told a senator to give me a blanking break. Economic advisor Christina Romer declared that Americans had yet to have their holy blank moment over the economy. Those who pay attention to political rhetoric say an unusual amount of profanity has emanated from the current situation. Now, lest we think that this is limited to the political realm, one of the things that I enjoy doing, Pastor Andrus, is officiating football.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, Friday night, get out on the football field with all the players.
Uh-huh.
And so last Friday night, I'm on the field with a not-to-be-named Christian school team,
mm-hmm.
varsity football game, and a public school team opponent.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't want to be graphic here, but the language was coarse.
Mm-hmm.
It was vulgar. And, of course, when I hear it, you know, I usually deal with it. I confront the player and I say, we're not going to use that language out here.
Mm-hmm.
If it's particularly direct, you know, I'll say something like, you need to make a decision right now if you want to stay in this game or watch it from the bench.
Mm-hmm.
And invariably, the players say, yes, sir, or you know, they get the message right away. And the reason they're doing it, Pastor, is because they're just used to doing it.
Yeah.
Not just on the football field, but probably wherever they go.
Mm-hmm.
So the question stands, what's with all the blanking language? Have you detected any of this?
You know, it's interesting. As I fly airplanes and I ride trains and buses, I will say I don't hear as much of it on airplanes as I do in buses and trains. And I'm not sure why. My thought has always been, as I both think of my own life as well as think of the students that I taught in confirmation class, an apple tree is going to grow apples. And we have a sinful nature. And if left untouched, untapped, uncontrolled, it'll bring forth what comes from that nature. And so when I hear that, I immediately think this is an uncontrolled person who has not disciplined themselves to stop the sinful nature from doing what it likes. And if one works at it with God's help, they can temper and control that, but it takes work, a lot of work. And some people don't want to put work into life. They just want to enjoy it, quote unquote.
Well, yesterday I went to the St. Louis Rams game.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to tell you, Pastor, if there's anything going to make you cuss, it's going to the St. Louis Rams game. But as I was enjoying, and I use that term loosely, the football game,
mm-hmm.
there was a couple seated to my right, and a middle-aged couple appeared to be, you know, reasonably well off.
Mm-hmm.
And I took it to be husband and wife.
Mm-hmm.
And since there was plenty to cuss about at the Rams game, that's pretty much what they were doing, using vulgar language. And I just thought to myself, wow, this is, I'm surprised to hear this kind of language in public coming from these otherwise seemingly educated and polished people. But apparently that's what we're doing now. The boundaries on language have apparently come down. And I think once they're down pretty much forever, don't you?
Well, history would say no. History would say that it goes in ebbs and cycles. That's why we have in history the pietistic movements that bring people back to the reality that when they let their lives be just embracing the experience without tempering and controlling.
So we need some pietism, do we?
Well, that's what history would say, that it'll swing back to a pietistic way. When that'll come, that's the thing we don't know.
Well, I have heard pietism discussed in rather negative terms on occasion. But the way you describe it sounds like it would be a good thing.
The pietistic movements brought a semblance of morality and ethics to all of society. The problem with the pietistic movement is when we point to that and say, there, see, they're saved. There's a difference between moralism and salvation. And too often people blur our deeds and actions, our words, into faith and relationship with Jesus. Those two are separate.
Have you ever, we got about a minute left here.
Okay.
As you deal with people, just to sort of come full circle here, who have been dealt a tough hand in life, and maybe as you listen to them, encourage them to talk, engage in some graphic language, do you let them, or do you deal with it?
I usually deal with it. And I don't let them. Maybe for the first couple sentences, because what I'm hearing come out with all the profanity and is anger. And you can't get to the root of the anger if you're only dealing with the surface. It's kind of like getting a splinter out of your hand if you got pus. You can't get that splinter out until some of that pus gets out there. Then you can get in and pull it out. So early on, I'll let some of it go. But then finally I say, excuse me, let's draw some ground rules here, and I would prefer you not to use that language because it's not necessary. That's not what's germane to what the situation is.
And does that usually work?
Yes.
Yeah, interesting. Well, we're out of time here. I always look forward to talking to you, Pastor Andrus. God's blessings on Lutheran Blind Mission.
Thank you.
Thank you for your insights.
A pleasure to be with you as always.
Tomorrow in the Bible study, Pastor John Lekomsky, I'm not going to get a word in edgewise tomorrow, Pastor John Lekomsky here for Luke 18, verses 31 and following, and then Pastor Nabil Noor, two of my favorite guys, Pastor Nabil Noor will be our guest and Ask the
Listen
Pastor.
Listen to Chuck Ratherton guests Monday through Friday at the same time on the Bible study. The Bible study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for the Bible study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of the Bible study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.